Think about the last time you couldn't find a parking spot. How you felt. Frustrated, monumentally pissed off, like someone had deprived you of a right, or that these idiots who designed this stupid building couldn't figure out the parking. In his book, the journalist Henry Grabar says all of that, all of those feelings are a pretty common urge we all share. In the book, he quotes a scholar who says, when we think about parking, it's playing out in the most primitive part of our brains, the same part that governs instinctive behaviors like aggression and dominance. And it's not hard to find stories where these impulses just erupt. Like a few years ago in Queens, New York, in a neighborhood called Flushing.
It's one of those places that is simultaneously very dense and vibrant and with great transit connections, but also very much at the heart of a borough that's pretty car-centric and where most households do own cars. So you have the perfect mix of ingredients for a parking fight. And what happened on this afternoon was that these two guys drove up and tried to park in the same parking spot. This is the kind of thing that has been pop culture fodder for Seinfeld and all sorts of other TV comedies. But this didn't turn into a comedy because the men got out of the car and started fighting, and one of them punched the other one in the face. One of the passengers produced a baseball bat, which he swung at the members of the other car. Then the first guy wrestled the bat away, and the other guy got back in his car. And he made a quick turn, and he came careening towards the guy with the baseball bat, flipped him up on the hood of the car, and sent the car right through the storefront of a bakery and all the way into the shop. I think five people went to the hospital. And the fellow who was driving the car that wound up inside the bakery was later arrested and charged with assault. I think the lesson of this story, and maybe the broader theme of the book, is that parking is something that is very, very important in our car-based transportation culture. And yet, it's a subject to which we have barely given any more thought than that momentary impulse of, where's my parking space? If you decide that this is going to be a system that we manage as poorly as we do, then you wind up with confrontations like this sometimes daily. Because if you look at it objectively, it is sort of insane. We have this system where everyone has their personal means of transportation, but the place you're going to leave that means of transportation is not determined until the moment you arrive at where you're going. And that would never happen with airplanes, right? Or trains or boats, right? You never set sail for some port not knowing if there was going to be a pier to hold you. But that's what we do every day with parking. And naturally, then, conflicts do emerge on a daily, hourly, minutely basis where people are going in for the same spot.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Henry Grabar is with us for the hour. His book explains why, in most cities in this country, parking rules everything around you. The economics of this story are really interesting, the politics and the history. He says parking has reshaped the physical landscape of American society. It's transformed the way we design and build our cities. It's even screwing up our good intentions. And no matter how frustrating it was for you last night or over the weekend to find a spot, Grabar says we have enough parking spots in this country. In fact, way too many. And if we could replace some of them with something else, he says we would have a city that is richer and fairer. But right now, we're obsessed about finding a parking spot, which Grabar describes as nothing less than the link between driving and life itself.
In the United States, I think something like 90% of trips are made in cars. And so when we think about the role of parking, often a neglected field shunned by people who work in either transportation or in architecture and development. Parking really is the key to all those car trips. And we talk a lot about the freedom of the open road and all that, but there is no freedom in driving unless there's a place for you to park. And the parking space really in that sense is as essential to the trip as the car and the road itself. And yet, as anyone can tell you, parking has certainly not received the literary or cinematic treatment that the cars and the roads have gotten for themselves. So it's long past time for its moment in the sun.
You yourself don't drive.
Well, I know how to drive. I just don't own a car.
You don't own a car. Let me put it that way. Sorry. which gets at your own interest in this subject. And I'm wondering if living in a city, not driving, if you've noticed this sort of from afar, or if you have a personal, like, how do you explain your own interest, at least your initial, the initial questions you wanted to ask about all of this?
Well, I think part of it, I should say, comes from my work as a journalist, because I would write stories about housing, transportation, the environment, landscape, all these subjects. And again, parking would come up as this central element that hadn't really been fully explored or explained. But you're right that the fact that I don't drive is also instrumental in shaping my perspective on this. And I think that's because only when you don't drive do you begin to look again at the sheer amount of land that is dedicated to parking. And when you're in a car, you just don't see that because you go over it so quickly, you go by it so quickly. And it's only when you're at the pace of someone on foot or even on a bicycle that it suddenly jumps out at you that this is the reason that our cities are so spread out and so difficult to get around any other way but in a car. And I think not being a regular driver is what enabled me to see that.
Hmm. It later in the book, you describe this. You describe it as an epiphany. You say there's this epiphany that beneath the parking lot, you know, the as you say, that the chassis of 1,000 parked cars, there is this tremendous potential. Did that sort of reveal itself as an epiphany at some point?
Well, that's the other part of it, I suppose, is that when you aren't in a car and you are considering the amount of space that's dedicated to parking, at a certain point, I began to think, what else could this space be used for?
Yeah.
And that's perhaps easiest to see with parking lots that occupy parcels of their own, right? Like an entire square block that's just a parking lot. And it's easy to look at that and say, well, we could build housing there. We could build an office building. We could build a soccer field, anything. But I think that's also something you can begin to see with curbside parking, which lines almost every city street, right? And I've thought about a lot of ways of exploring this arbitrage, right? Which is that the land is pretty valuable, but it's only dedicated and reserved for one single use, which is parking a car. And I've thought about ways in which this arbitrage reveals itself. And I think one of the first ones is the presence of ice cream trucks, taco trucks, food trucks, et cetera, right? I mean, that's commercial operators saying this space has been reserved for parking, but there's actually better things we could do with it. And so that's where you see that realization beginning to peep through. But then obviously the more fundamental change for many of us came during the pandemic when restaurants began to open seating areas in their parking lots or on the curb in front of their establishments. And that was a particularly funny moment for me because in my reporting, restaurant owners had often been the most vociferous advocates for more parking. I mean, they are convinced that their business lives or dies based on the amount of parking that's provided. But suddenly when you say to them, hey, you know, you can use this parking for something else, well, all of a sudden that parking doesn't seem so important anymore. And I think that's a realization that many of us had watching that transformation during the pandemic. And restaurant seating is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the types of things we could do with that space.
You mentioned early on in the book that, you know, despite all of the consternation there is and problems with parking, that there is this incredible ignorance of the systemic consequences connected to parking. It's a subject you say that is overlooked? And first of all, explain that and explain why that would be.
Well, one reason parking is overlooked in the popular image of automobile culture is obvious. Parking sucks. It's boring. And there's just no charismatic element to parking, right? Like, it's just a square of asphalt. It's basically like writing about sand, except that sand can be like whipped into attractive formations and people like to throw down a towel on it and lie in front of the waves. Not so with the parking lot. And people sometimes ask me, how is it that nobody wrote this book before? And I know the answer to that question. And it's actually pretty challenging to make this an engaging subject. And I did my best, but it took a long time to try and find the right characters that would bring this subject to life. And I think that's an obvious issue that parking has as a subject, and one of the reasons it's been relatively ignored. I think the other thing that has happened in the United States is that we, for a long time, had a pretty significant group of urban planners who were really focused on parking. And if you look at research out of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, you see giant reports dedicated to solving the parking problem and figuring out how we were going to deal with this. And there's a tremendous amount of intellectual firepower going into figuring out this question. And that vanishes in about the 1970s and 80s. And the reason that happens is because we solved the parking problem. I mean, we as a country essentially created enough parking so that very, very few of us have to think on a daily basis about where we're going to park, how much it's going to cost, et cetera, and even fewer of us need to fight over those spots. So I think that's one of the answers to the question, is that it took a while for the pendulum to swing in the opposite direction. And now what you're seeing, I think, is a realization on the part of activists for a variety of causes that we have made a lot of sacrifices to obtain that free and easy parking that characterizes the American experience.
One of the things you also mentioned in the book is that some of the writing about these consequences, systemic consequences of parking, were done with a kind of disdain for the suburbs and for the people who live in suburbs. Say something about that. You address this a bit in the book. You say often the attitude was condescending. It could be classist, something that you're just not interested in doing. But explain what that they were sort of talking down to or not really considering the realities of people who live in suburbs or have real incentives that get them into the suburbs, I guess.
Yeah, this gets back to the question of parking as the link between driving and life itself. Most of us live in places where we have no choice but to drive. We have no choice but to drive to participate in the labor market, to get to school, to see our friends, to go shopping, to experience the amenities of our city or town. That's just reality. That is the way the planning system has been working over the last 50, 60 years. And again, it's been remarkably successful in creating that environment for us. So I don't think it's very productive to talk about drivers as the architects of this system and pin the responsibility for some of the problems that ensued from our parking abundant landscape on drivers, because it's really not their fault. And in many cases, I think many people who drive everywhere would actually love to be able to walk to a restaurant or live in a neighborhood where their kids could walk to school or ride a bike safely with their family to get to the Little League fields or something like that. I mean, I think real estate prices indicate that some of the most in-demand neighborhoods in our cities are very much those walkable places. And so that gets to the classism component of it. You can't really just say, you know, you villainous drivers, why don't you just move to a place where you'd only need one car per household instead of three? Well, I think many people would like to do that, but it's simply not feasible. And I think so when we think about parking as a systemic issue, it's a system, right? And we need to think about the policies that got us into this place rather than trying to tell this story as a matter of individual personal responsibility.
That's Henry Grabar. He's a staff writer at Slate, author of the book Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Well, let's, as you do in the book, let's back up and talk a little bit about how we got here, some of the early, but let's go way back, at least say something about the fact that you mention the parking problem, quote unquote, is as old as the road itself. Say something about that. I mean, this goes way back, obviously before cars, or at least the idea or the notion here. And it's, I think it's worth saying something about that.
This is actually pretty important because I get the sense from reading accounts of the early days of the automobile that the parking hadn't really been thought through as an obvious externality that would be part and parcel of car culture. And I think one reason for that is that people were accustomed to thinking about parking already, but they just thought about it in terms of horse and buggies, right? Mm-hmm. Because they needed parking too. But the problem that was posed by horse and carriages was very, very different. And this gets to the whole history of parking, right? Like, obviously, there have been vehicles on roads for thousands of years, but the important difference is that those vehicles were hitched to animals, and animals needed to eat, and animals needed to sleep and do other things. And so you couldn't just leave your animals hitched to your cart at the center of town for days and days at a time. Not to mention that operating an animal-pulled cart was somewhat expensive and wouldn't have been an everyday practice for an everyday citizen, whether it was Rome in the first century or New York in the 19th century. That obviously all changes with the automobile, because the automobile can be stored year-round, hours, days, months at a time. And also, obviously, because the automobile is so affordable by the arrival of the Model T that it really becomes something that almost everybody has by, you know, the middle of the 20th century. And that obviously changes the nature of the parking problem in a fundamental way.
What do cities start to do? So the car arrives 1908. Urban planners, city leaders are having to sort of figure out what to do. And suddenly the idea of parking and a parking problem, at least for cars, is an issue. You mentioned how they one of the things they did early on was established time limits. That was like one of the – which that was interesting. I didn't realize that that was such an early idea.
In the early 20th century, there was a huge body of research dedicated to thinking about parking. And one of the realizations that they had was that parking and traffic were essentially the same problem, and that these big urban traffic jams were often caused by people looking for parking, people giving up and double parking. So if you were able to solve the parking problem, you could also greatly, you know, make great progress on the traffic problem. Time limits come along as a way to do just that. There's a realization that the utility of the curb is being taken up by people who, for example, work in downtown businesses or even worse, live downtown and leave their cars there for days at a time. And so people who go down to run a quick errand find that there's nowhere to park. So time limits is a way to create room for those shoppers, basically, to create room for the vitality that characterizes a highly functioning curb. They don't work that well because it's very, very hard to enforce time limits. But pretty soon in 1935, a new device gets invented which perfects the power of the time limit, and that's the parking meter, because parking meters effectively do the same thing by reducing the amount of time people are willing to park. And when the parking meter is invented, the reactions are euphorious. People simply cannot believe the extent to which this device manages to bring order to the curbs by pushing long-term parkers into out-of-the-way spots and leaving those primo parking spots right on Main Street for people who need to run errands or shop at local shops.
Well, you mentioned that the parking meter, this is that you say that's the prototype for how parking should be done. It's a really progressive idea, and it works. It seems to work anyway. This is around 1935. Why did people move on from it? Why didn't it completely work? If it's the prototype for how it should be done, I mean, yes, there are parking meters and we use them, of course, but why didn't it solve the larger problem, I guess?
Well, the parking meter works really well in the decades after it's implemented, but urban planners and city business interests have a kind of crisis of confidence as far as the parking meter goes in the 1950s and 60s because they begin to face competition from the suburbs, right? And the suburbs offer free and ample parking. It is everywhere. I mean, this is, you know, this is something so banal and fundamental to the suburban experience that sometimes we don't even think about it. But when suburban malls were opening in the 1950s, this was one of the first things they advertised. It was always free and ample parking because this was, in many ways, the distinguishing feature between what they were offering and what the downtown department stores were struggling with, which was high-priced parking or parking three or four blocks away, and certainly not knowing exactly where you were going to be able to park. And the suburban mall solves all those problems. And for the first time in human history, people encounter the phenomenon of losing their car in the parking lot. I mean, that had never happened before. And one of the results of that is that in cities, the parking meter, which just decades before had been hailed as this kind of miracle worker that brought order to city streets, begins to be seen as a disadvantage. And merchants grow very concerned that unless cities also have free parking, they will lose the competition to suburban shops.
So they start widening roads and chopping off stoops and cutting down street trees. And you've talked about how at some point these big multi-story parking garages comes to be seen as this is the fix. Talk a little bit about this moment. You say that some city planners and architects have this kind of grand vision for these garages, that they're going to be like the great train stations that you see in European countries.
I know. Isn't it funny to imagine? Can you imagine you pull into the downtown parking garage and there's a big, vast hall, people milling about, having espressos.
A great clock.
Yeah, exactly. It did not come to pass. And in fact, as I'm sure you're aware, I feel like parking garages are actually some of the people's most despised features of the urban landscape. Like, they're scary, they're dangerous, they're gross. Like, nobody wants to hang out in a parking garage. But at any rate, they did believe in them at the time. Yeah. And they really saw the solution to this urban parking problem not lying in management, right, in sort of ordering the streets and finding new ways for people to travel, and certainly not in using parking meters, but rather simply in focusing exclusively on increasing the parking supply. And the thought was, there is really no limit to how much parking we can create and have that still be good for the city, right? There's no upper limit. We should just absolutely go all in on creating as much parking as possible, and downtown garages were certainly part of that plan.
In the book, you have this image of downtown Denver, two images, actually. One image from the 1920s, where you have, you know, lots of buildings and shops. And then there's another from the 1970s, where basically parking lots have displaced most of the buildings. And I liked this reference to, there's this urban designer named Mark Childs you mentioned. He said, it's like moths devouring a lace wedding gown, or like an ice sculpture, I think is another way you describe it later. They just keep whittling away at. And I wanted you to talk about that, and not just that they had done it, but what did it do to the just American architecture, the look and the feel of cities?
I think it's hard to put ourselves in the footsteps of the mid-century planner who is looking at a congested downtown and comprehend the degree to which, in just a couple decades, so much of that landscape would become parking lots. I mean, the speed and scale of the transformation is truly remarkable. And I think there comes a point, and you see this in some of the literature from the 1970s, where they look back and they say, you know what? We actually might have too much parking now. Hmm. And that begins to set in as planners take stock of the tax base, the sort of vitality of these blocks, the skyline, but also the architectural profile of the city. One of the ways, one of the principal ways that city planners go about increasing the amount of parking that's available is they build parking into the zoning code. And the zoning code, right, is the rules that say what you're allowed to do with your property. In the 1950s, most cities adopt a provision that says whatever you do with this property, you have to provide a certain number of parking spaces according to how many apartments you build, how big the restaurant is, how many tennis courts are in your tennis facility, and so on. And those laws not only create a ton of parking, but they also fundamentally change the way American architecture works, because there are all kinds of vernacular building designs that are popular in the first half of the 20th century that become impossible to build beginning in the 1950s and 60s. And, you know, of course, hypothetically, you could just put the parking underground and continue to build triple deckers and painted ladies and brownstones and bungalow courts and all this other stuff. But in practice, it doesn't work that way because underground parking is very expensive to build. And so that never really pans out. And as a result, the whole architectural profile of the country makes a turn away from these types of infill forms. And really, on a lot of these parcels in a lot of these cities, it becomes very hard to build anything at all.
Well, you mentioned that one of the reasons people haven't wanted to write about parking is there doesn't seem to be a lot of stories there. It's one of the things that you do a lot in the book is tell stories of different people and the relationship with parking. Let's talk a little bit about Anna Russi. She's the, as you say, the top parking attendant in New York City. In writing about her, you kind of explore this, I don't know, intensity, hatred, I suppose we have, or maybe this fear we feel about parking tickets. Talk a little bit about this part of the book and the story you're trying to tell here.
So parking meters eventually do make a return in a lot of places. Unfortunately, they're often managed not to create the most utility out of this precious interface between the street and building, but rather simply just to make money. And motorists have a sense of this and often take it out on the people charged with doing parking enforcement. And I talk to a lot of people who work in parking enforcement, and I think it's probably one of the most miserable jobs you can have. Anna Russi was a traffic cop in New York City, and I talked to her for a long time about the work that she did there and the abuse that she and her colleagues suffered at the hands of angry motorists and even policemen, because no one seems to be above getting mad, getting violent about getting a parking ticket.
There's this writer and parking, I don't know, I guess activist you could call him, John Van Horn, you write about, who has this theory I wanted to discuss with you. You mentioned it in the book. He has this theory about parking tickets and why it is that people hate them. And one of the things he says is that people believe, you know, somewhere in some ancient or grand document is this right that has been granted all human beings to park for free. Talk a little bit about that impulse, this idea that we feel like we shouldn't have to pay for parking.
I mean, I think it's understandable because we have spent so long operating in an environment where most parking that's provided is free. So it's very much second nature to assume that the parking will be free. And then second to that also, I think there's also a sense that parking is a pretty low value product, right? I mean, it's just a strip of asphalt. How much could it cost? And so there's a feeling that whether you're paying the meter or you're getting a ticket, if you're paying anything for it at all, it feels like a huge ripoff. That sentiment is actually wrong, but it's hard to understand that because the land is lying in such a basic function being used as a parking lot. But of course, if you're looking at some of those big city curbs that Anna Russi used to patrol, I mean, those land values there are literally the highest land values on the planet Earth. And you can park your car there for $2 an hour. I mean, it's the bargain of the century. And yet even $2 an hour begins to seem like an immoral sum to pay for that.
So you don't want to, trash suburbanites or anything like that in the book in any way. But I do want to ask about what you learned about human nature in some of the things you reveal in the book. I mean, you talk about the fact that drivers take 21% longer to leave a spot if someone is waiting. I'm just reading from the book here. If their holding is suddenly worth more, well, what's the other one? 33% longer if the arriving driver honks. In July of 2020, a man in Park City, this caught my eye because we're here in Utah, called 911 to report he couldn't find a parking spot. What did you learn about human nature?
I think most people are basically good people and trying to do the best. And parking is one of the aspects of our life in which we don't often cover ourselves in glory. But again, I wouldn't put too much blame on the people who are doing the parking there. I think it's an irritating assignment in a system that is designed to leave us miserable, either because we're in a car and frustrated that we've been stuck driving and obligated to drive, and yet the final leg of the journey hasn't been accounted for. But then also, obviously, if you're not in a car, it does feel like much of the world has been designed to accommodate free and easy parking in a way that often feels like it's flying in the face of the things you want and need.
Henry Grabar, his book is Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. I think probably every city, most cities anyway in the country, certainly Salt Lake City, is contending with the idea of how to get more affordable housing. And you mentioned in the book that in every state in the country, there's this story where you have an affordable housing project that has basically been undone just because of the demands over parking. You tell the story of one in particular in Solana Beach, California, The Pearl. Talk a little bit about that particular story and what that tells us about that conflict between trying to build affordable housing and contend with this impulse, this need for parking.
The Pearl was a 10-unit affordable housing building that was set to be built in Solana Beach, which is a suburb of San Diego, and one of the constraints that the developer faced in undertaking this project was the project was set to be built on a parking lot. And one of the non-negotiable elements of this deal was that she reconstruct all the parking spaces from the parking lot as part of her new project and integrate them into her new building alongside the spaces that would be reserved for residents. And so what ended up happening in Solana Beach was she wound up saddled with this enormous expense of building a giant underground garage, and the 10 units on top were almost incidental to the project. And you do see this sometimes, especially in California near the beach, where the obligation to ensure that there's enough parking means that housing projects often are asked to bear the costs of everybody else's car transportation.
Yeah.
Now, that's not the only thing that happened in Solana Beach, and I would add there's two reasons that parking interferes with the cost, with the ability to provide housing. And one is cost, which I just talked about, right? It costs a lot of money. But the other one is neighbors. And what happened in Solana Beach that ultimately did this project in was a lawsuit that was filed by the neighbors alleging that the replacement parking would not be as good as the original parking that would be demolished to make way for the building. So that's ultimately what sank the project. And Solana Beach is a kind of outlandish and egregious example of people using parking as a way to thwart new neighbors moving into their neighborhood. But I think this happens on a pretty regular basis at community meetings across the country, where every time the idea of more neighbors moving to the neighborhood is proposed, one of the principal objections that gets raised is not over classroom sizes or the amount of people using the park or how long the line is going to be for coffee at Starbucks, right? It's not about those things. It's about parking. It's about the competition for parking. And that is time and time again a factor that gets cited in turning down new neighbors. And that's become a major issue in American economic geography. You see it obviously all across the West now. that housing has become super expensive. It's super hard to build housing. And that's changing the way people live, the places people move, et cetera. And based on surveys I've seen, parking is often the primary concern. And so it begins to seem like the actual quest for parking and neighbors' defensiveness over existing parking in their neighborhood is actually reshaping the country's population geography.
But is it actually a concern over parking, or is that just a kind of a euphemism for something else that they're concerned about that might be related to race or class?
That is a very challenging question to answer. And we cannot know what is in the hearts of our fellow neighbors who stand up and yell parking at the community meeting. But I think one thing we can do is we can make sure to defang parking as a tool of opposition to new housing. I think we should take it for granted that housing at this point is more important than parking. And one thing we can do is when people get up in the meeting and they say, what about the parking? We shouldn't even ask about their motivations for asking about parking. We should simply say, parking is important, but at this point in our society, given the problems we face, housing is more important. You're starting to see that type of rhetoric in some places, especially on the West Coast, in California, Oregon, and Washington. They've started to take parking out of the process at the community level so that projects can no longer be canceled on the grounds of not having enough parking.
Which gets to some of the solutions you work through in the book or talk about. One of them is to abolish these parking minimums and let developers, you know, build the amount of parking that their clients actually want. One of them is breaking this connection between garage rental from apartment rental. And I guess what I'm wondering is, do you think that you can break down the incentives that have those things in place in the first place to be able to get to those solutions?
I think it's a no-brainer to stop requiring more parking than we need, right? We've seen how that requirement drives up the cost of housing, makes our architecture uglier, makes our neighborhoods less walkable, harms our environment, and so forth. So I think it's long past time to let developers respond to the needs of their clients. And they will provide parking, and they do when these laws go away, but they often provide the correct amount of parking that they need rather than the excess that has been written into the code. Now, can these changes happen on their own? Well, one answer is they already are happening. But of course, we can't expect Americans to decide not to drive unless those changes to the design of homes and apartments are accompanied by changes in the design of the streets. And this is really important, right? Like the reason that you can look at cities like London or Paris or Tokyo or Mexico City or even Vancouver and Montreal, and they have lowered their requirements for parking, developers build less parking, more people walk, ride the bus, ride bikes, etc. That's because the streets are safe for those activities and destinations are close at hand. And that's obviously not the case in a lot of American cities. And that's obviously going to be a problem as we begin to think about trying to decarbonize our society, get people to drive less, potentially walk more, et cetera. But the good news is that in a lot of cities, there actually are a bunch of destinations that are relatively close to where people live. So now the average American household owns 2.2 cars. So I think we're not saying that all of a sudden people are going to give up their cars, but it's about change on the margins. And that change at the margins happens not because people are not driving to work anymore, but because they're able to do things in their neighborhood on foot, on bike, et cetera, and they feel safe doing that. And that's a change that doesn't just concern the interaction of developers and parking codes, but is up to every really city planning commission to say, you know what, for a while we thought it was important for cars to go 55 miles an hour here, but now we think it's important for kids to be able to walk to school. And those things are actually diametrically opposed, and you have to pick one.
So I think that's one of the sort of hopeful messages in the book, is that it doesn't seem like you think we've – because that is the question. Did we lose out on the opportunity to do something when we first started building parking lots? I mean, can you really go back? And I don't mean whether parking lots can be torn up and made into something else. But if you think about this kind of in evolutionary terms, have we already adapted to this new habitat and structured our lives and our cultures into this new reality? And then now how do you change that? And can we change that? Sounds like you think we can.
I think we can. You know, you asked me earlier about photos of Denver, the before and after. Well, have you looked at a photo of Denver today? I mean,
yeah.
Denver today
yeah.
is booming. It is absolutely jam-packed with new buildings. And that entire area that was parking lots in the 1970s, has much of it has been rebuilt. And so, yes, change is possible. I think what's challenging is that it does depend on a kind of cycle being started. And in that cycle, you have land uses that require less parking, that are more walkable. And once you have people living in those places, you have commerce that arises nearby to cater to their needs, right? And then all of a sudden, you have more people who want to live nearby and more people walking. And the more people walk, the more businesses open. And maybe some point, there's enough kids in the neighborhood that there's time to build a new school or something like that. And so gradually, you watch the evolution of a neighborhood take place. And that can happen, right? And that's not beyond the realm of possibility, I don't think.
One of the things that you mentioned is that in the wake of the pandemic, you started to see these signs everywhere that pointed to these, you know, big changes in the place of parking in American life. And I wondered what you learned about that moment when we were rethinking our lives because we were, you know, isolated in our houses, or we're rethinking our trips to the store, the office. What were the lessons, do you think, we learned about our ability to adapt to a different kind of reality if we choose it?
Well, I already talked about one thing that happened during the pandemic, which I think was important, which is this realization that street space could be used for other things besides parking.
Yeah, like restaurants.
Yeah, restaurants, but also like we could plant, you know, trees, right? And that's so obvious, you don't even really think about it, but that would make our streets so much more pleasant. And as we talk about creating that cycle where people actually want to walk places, one of the biggest determinants, of course, of whether people want to walk someplace is whether there are trees, because they provide shade in the summer and also just look really nice and make people feel good. That's one thing that came out of the pandemic. The other, obviously, is the rise of remote work, which to me represents an opportunity in some ways, because you have so many more people spending so much more time in their neighborhoods. When you look at the distribution of how Americans travel, the commute is something like 95% made in a car alone, right? And that's because our geography of jobs is pretty sprawling and really, really hard to retrofit to be accessible via transit. So that's a place where I am more pessimistic about the possibility of, you know, everybody getting on the bus and going to work. Like, it's not the 1930s anymore. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
However, the optimistic thing is that lots of people do live in neighborhoods where destinations are relatively close at hand. And I think with more people spending more time in those neighborhoods, they've begun to say, well, why can't I walk from here to there? And why are these streets so unsafe? And why is it that this environment is so degraded as a pedestrian? And what can we do about it? And I think that kind of activism and interest becomes possible because people are spending more time in their neighborhoods. And I'm optimistic about that. And then the flip side of that is that in downtowns where you have a smaller share of workers going to the office, suddenly you have even more excess parking space than you had before. And that is a tremendous opportunity because we've already talked about the enormous costs that get imposed on builders of housing when they need to include, say, two parking spaces with every apartment. I mean, it's just a massive amount of money that goes into pouring that concrete, building that garage, the opportunity cost of all that land and square footage that's not occupied with housing and so on. Well, now you've got all this spare capacity in all these downtown garages and lots. And I would love to see that get used up by new residents moving into the neighborhood in more affordable buildings, opting for a more affordable parking option, which is, you know, parking a couple blocks away in a garage. So that, again, represents an enormous opportunity to come out of the pandemic.
Yeah. You write about how in New York City during the pandemic, how people talked about how, you know, when people were transforming their the space outside of the restaurant into seating for the restaurant itself, that it seemed like this massive transformation was going on. But in fact, you said out of the like 3 million curbside parking spaces, that brief moment of the coronavirus only displaced about 8,500 of them. And it raises the question that if that relatively small number could cause, you know, a paradigm shift, what could you do with, as you say in the book, 50,000 or 500,000 spots? And it makes me wonder, how would all of this, if we could rethink this, how would it transform the way our cities look and feel, do you think?
It is hard to even imagine the scale of transformation that would be possible if you could take even 10% of the parking in this country and turn it into other things. But, you know, there are some cities that are doing stuff like this, right? And I think what's happening is you get more public space, more places for people to sit, more places for older people to sit, which in turn makes older people more likely to walk places, which in turn makes them more social and healthier and all that. More places for kids to play. You know, Paris has started this program where they close the streets in front of schools to turn them into these kind of pretty low-touch public plazas. But just because they're in front of schools, they wind up turning into these giant play spaces, even though there's really no design at all. And all they've really done is taken away 40 parking spaces. And the other thing is greenery. And I think this is a huge part of it, is we're dealing right now with climate crisis that has caused our cities to get hotter and to get wetter. And we've seen every summer now, it seems like there's some cataclysmic flash flooding event caused by a place getting, you know, 13 inches of rain in 24 hours that had never seen rainfall like that before. Now, one response to that is, well, we can just rebuild the entire sewer system to be that much bigger, to handle that much more rain. But the other is we can take some of this gray space, some of this pavement, and turn it into territory that will hold the rain where it falls, which is to say making our cities greener. And that has the additional advantage of also just making our cities more pleasant, cleaning the air, shading the streets, et cetera. So that, to me, seems like killing several birds with one stone and actually probably also inviting lots of birds to come to the city in the first place.
Yeah. You sound hopeful. I mean, you mentioned that you mentioned Paris. You write about Amsterdam, London, Colombia, certainly Japan, how this tide is turning. But you feel hopeful about the U.S. as well? We're not outliers in this tide?
It's funny. I'm often reluctant to bring up what's happening in Tokyo or Amsterdam because I think people's first reaction is to say, well, what does that have to do with us? I mean, we're not Amsterdam. Okay, well, Amsterdam wasn't always Amsterdam either. I mean, Amsterdam had crushing traffic jams in the 1960s, and they had lots of kids die because they got hit by cars, and they just decided, no, we're not going to take it anymore. And they changed the way they ran their city and changed the way people got around. And this is happening in America, too. I mean, Atlanta has a giant two-way bike lane going right through downtown. Cincinnati has used COVID recovery money to close streets to provide lots of seating areas for restaurants. Washington, D.C. is talking about redesigning Pennsylvania Avenue to potentially be entirely car-free and plant more trees and create more space for people on bikes and in buses and all that. So I see this happening across the country. It's just it's happening in fits and starts. And obviously, there's a tremendous amount of resistance, not even from drivers so much as from elected officials who I think still think of themselves as working for a community of drivers, when in reality, nobody is a driver, right? It's just that lots of people spend a lot of time behind the wheel. But when you make those improvements to the streets that can serve everybody, that distinction sort of goes away. And I think lots of people have found that some of these places that were created, for example, during COVID, like San Francisco kicking the cars out of Golden Gate Park, they haven't looked back. They had a citywide vote and they decided they were going to keep it that way.
Henry Gabar, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Henry Gabar, he's a staff writer at Slate. His book is Paved Paradise: How Parking Explains the World. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.